The same environmental disadvantages that penalize food production throughout the American intermontane West also limit Montana's suitability for growing crops and raising livestock. They are relatively low rainfall, resulting in low rates of plant growth, high latitude and high altitude, resulting in a short growing season, and distance from markets. What those disadvantages mean is that anything grown in Montana can be grown more cheaply and with higher productivity elsewhere in North America. Hence, Montana's history consists of attempts to answer the fundamental question, how to make a living in this beautiful but agriculturally non-competitive land. Human occupation of Montana falls into several economic phases. The first phase was of Native Americans, who arrived at least 13,000 years ago. In contrast to the agricultural societies that they developed in eastern and southern North America, Montana's Native Americans were hunter-gatherers. The first recorded Europeans to visit were the members of the Lewis and Clark Expedition of 1804 to 1806. They were followed by Montana's second economic phase, involving the mountain men, fur trappers and traders coming down from Canada and also from the U.S. The next phase began in the 1860s and was based on three foundations of Montana's economy that have continued until the present: mining, logging, and food production. The influx of miners to Montana's big copper mine at Butte stimulated other sectors of the economy to meet the needs of that internal market within the state. Timber was taken out of the nearby Bitterroot Valley to provide power for the mines, to construct houses, and to shore up the mine shafts, and food for the miners was grown in the valley. Although the valley's rainfall is low at 13 inches per year, the settlers in the 1860s already began overcoming that disadvantage by building small irrigation ditches fed by streams draining the snow-capped Bitterroot Mountains on the valley's west side, and later by engineering two sets of large-scale and expensive irrigation systems. Among other things, irrigation permitted a boom in apple orchards that began in the 1880s and peaked in the early decades of this century. But today, few of those orchards remain in commercial operation. Montana's environmental problems today include almost all of the dozen types of problems that have undermined pre-industrial societies in the past. Particularly conspicuous in Montana are problems of toxic wastes, forests, soils, water, and sometimes air, climate change, biodiversity losses, and introduced pests. Let's begin with seemingly the most transparent problem, that of toxic wastes. While concern is mounting in Montana about runoff of fertilizer, manure, septic tanks, and herbicides, by far the biggest toxic waste issue is posed by residues from metal mining, some of it from the last century, and some of it recent or ongoing. No one disagrees that mining is essential somewhere and somehow. Modern civilization and its chemical, construction, electric, and electronic industries run on metals. The question is, where and how best to mine metal-bearing ores? Unfortunately, the ore concentrate that is eventually carried away from a Montana mine represents only a fraction of the earth that must first be dug up. The remainder are waste rock and tailings still containing copper, arsenic, cadmium, and zinc, which are toxic to people, as well as to fish, wildlife, and livestock, and hence are bad news when they get into groundwater, rivers, and soil. In addition, Montana ores are rich in iron sulfide, which yields sulfuric acid. In Montana, there are about 20,000 abandoned mines, some of them recent, but many of them a century or more old, that will be leaking acid and those toxic metals, essentially, forever. In Montana, as elsewhere, companies that have acquired older mines respond to demands to pay for cleanup in either of two ways. Especially if the company is small, its owners may declare the company bankrupt, in some cases conceal its assets, and transfer their business efforts to new companies. If the company is so large that it cannot claim bankruptcy, it instead denies responsibility, or else seeks to minimize the costs. In either case, either the mine site and areas downstream of it remain toxic, thereby endangering people, or else taxpayers pay for the cleanup through the federal superfund and a corresponding Montana state fund. It is easy for us non-miners to become indignant at mining companies and to view their behavior as morally culpable. In fact, the moral issue is more complex. It's a cruel fact that no simple, cheap way exists to clean up old mines. Early miners behaved as they did because the government required almost nothing of them. Not until 1971 did the state of Montana pass a law requiring mining companies to clean up their property when their mine closed. Even rich companies that may be inclined to clean up become reluctant to do so when they realize that they may then be asked to do the impossible, or that the costs will be excessive, or that the achievable results will be less than the public expected. When the mine owner can't or won't pay, taxpayers don't want to step in and pay billions of dollars of cleanup costs either. Most taxpayers balk at spending money if there isn't an immediate crisis, and not enough taxpayers complain about toxic waste or support high taxes. In this sense, we the public bear the ultimate responsibility. Only when the public pressures its politicians into passing laws demanding different behavior from mining companies will the companies behave differently.